So thanks, Andy. As you said, I work for People Browser. Quick one sentence, what we do social media. And that's what I generally say to people. And they say, have you got a one or 15-word answer? Our founder, Jody Rich, back in 2008, decided to form a commercial relationship with Twitter. And so we have access to, since about November 2008, every single tweet that any of you in this room have actually generated. So we have about 55 billion tweets that we've collected since 2008, including the drunk ones you deleted because you thought you'd get rid of them. We've got them and then we have them. And that is about 1,000 days. And so the reason why Anthony Gandy's asked me to talk about mining social networks and also demographics is once you have a great mass of data, you can do a lot of things with it. And I want to give you a couple of specific case studies on what you can do with it. Do the old space bar. Picture here of little brother here being rained down on by all this data. I think I agree with some of what Anne said and some I'm going to disagree with. I think Facebook will be around in 5 years. Today, Google turned 13. And who would have thought that a white website with 17 or 18 words on it would actually last 13 years? They got the model right because they realized what people wanted to do. I think why Facebook will still be around in 2016 is it's kind of come to default. And I work in this industry as many do, and I kind of look at the coffee table or coffee shop overheard conversation to see whether something's cut through. If I ask you to put your hands up who's on Facebook, everyone will put their hand up. My parents aren't on Facebook yet, but I'm sure they're not far away. And so when I overhear conversations in coffee shops about I'm on Facebook or I want to tweet you this or whatever, I know that it's starting to break through. When you see TV ads from major brands like Pepsi, and the call to action on the last slide is go to facebook.com/Pepsi, that is a revolution in itself because someone has bothered over the last 10 years to build Pepsi a fantastic website with all this great stuff, and now you're saying go to someone else's brand because that's where the eyeballs are. I think what will happen in 2016 is that most of the male, older marketing directors that are out there would have probably retired, and many of us in the room will be in those senior positions, and we obviously get this, and it's native, and it's the default. So maybe in 5 years' time, we won't have a discussion about should we have a social media strategy, should we be on Facebook. In fact, let's rewind our minds to 12 years ago. The thing called the web came around. And back then, everyone said, should we have a website? Should we even bother with the web? We kind of know how the story ends. So when people say, do we need a social media strategy? I often say, well, let's look at what happened 12 years ago, and we kind of know how the story ends. So I think Facebook will be around, but it's right to question it, everything you talked about in terms of where things are going. However, this thing called broadcast television has been around for 50 years, and we are conditioned to watch a thing like The X Factor, and we are okay with every 15 minutes the action stopping and we're watching a message from the sponsors. In fact, who here on Facebook has ever clicked and bought something because of an ad they've seen on Facebook? No hands, 0%. That's interesting, isn't it? Because their whole model is on advertising because that's where the money is. So back to my somewhat ageist, white, male, grey head is that people that understand TARPs and reach and frequency and audience profiles, they'll keep putting money where they know they can. So that's why we'll keep seeing Facebook ads for Pepsi. But I think what we don't know about is, you know, how this is going to grow. At the moment, there are about 10,000 posts a second coming out of Twitter, which is quite a lot. Anyone in the room know how many SMSs are sent a second around the world? Anyone have a guess? It's 100,000 a second. That's kind of the benchmark because everyone SMSs. That's kind of become the benchmark. So we're about a tenth of the way away until social media and the noise generator gets to the sort of SMS level. And the challenge for us is how do you keep up with that? Because we've got to capture all this stuff in real time. And so at the 100,000 a second, you've got 10 billion conversations, of which 1% of that is gold. And part of what I'm talking about tonight is how do you mine that? How do you find that needle in the haystack to find out what's going on? And it isn't about how many likes you have or how many followers you have. It's what's that rich information about something I can do with an improved branding. And I think the web was a revolution in itself, but I think social media is another revolution because 3 or 4 years ago, if you had a problem with a brand, you would ring the customer service person, someone at BT maybe, and you would say, I have a problem and I'm annoyed and I'm angry. And they are trained to cope with that. In fact, the hospitality industry is the best trained industry for this because it's always, Mr. Grill, it's not a problem. Elephant in your room tomorrow, not a problem, Mr. Grill. Who here has had a bad experience in a hotel and they're upgraded and we spend our time telling our friends about the upgrade, not about the bad experience? Now, BT is a great example. I'm sure Warren will cover it. I no longer call BT. I tweet them. two reasons. One, I know they've got 20-odd people in Northern Ireland that will respond to my call. Secondly, I'm on your hit list because you know about me. You'll probably talk also about the fact that the call volumes have decreased from people like me calling the call center, and specific people can actually deal with it as well. So I now call the Twitter handle, and I know I get my problem resolved. I think if we step back and how sort of social media has developed, that, you know, way back when we were all swinging through the trees, and then we emerged from the jungle with some sort of language. We worked out how to speak and communicate with each other, and then we decided to write it down, which is not so long ago, and we've worked how to do that. And then what's happened is, with all the internet and mobile phones, we've actually worked out how to connect all this together. And I think why it's a revolution is that now I can tweet right now from the stage about Warren's brand or Vodafone or someone to say I'm upset. And because I can broadcast that to a lot of people, and a lot of Warren's team are worried about that and the brand image and everything else, they take notice. And so I've now got the power in my hands. So even though I'm little brother, if I can do something with this data and look at my networks and actually do something with it, I then become very powerful on a personal level. So we now have this collective stream of intelligence. And what we can do is, once we've got this massive data, you can start doing something with that. And that's what I'm going to talk about tonight. So I think the little brother, that's all of us here, will have a higher intelligence because we're more connected. And unfortunately, if you work in advertising, I no longer watch or listen to your ads. If I need something, it's a pain point. New car, new mobile phone, new home, new loan. I'll go and ask the audience, my audience or network of friends. And I'll trust them because I know what answer I'm going to get. So Gabrielle at the back, I know personally and professionally. And if I want to get a recommendation on something, I trust her recommendation. And I know if she's recommended from someone else, it's probably a good idea. But I don't watch ads anymore. So why I think Facebook will be around is that, and I know this because I'm in and out of ad agencies every single day, they are forming social network departments because they're trying to figure out what's next when brands wake up and the marketing budgets move from big bad TV into this other stuff. How do they stay ahead? In fact, the typewriter, my daughter Madeline is 5, and I showed her a picture of this last night, and I said, you know what this is? Paper goes in. He said, oh, Daddy, that's how they used to write emails in the olden days. So even 5-year-olds are seeing that this is the future, that this is what you do. And Madeline's actually quite adept on the keyboard. She was on the top of the double-decker bus on the weekend, and her mum was downstairs, and I was up here with her, and we were typing a message to mummy on my keyboard, on my BlackBerry, and she was tapping away like a pretty good one-finger typist as a 5-year-old. So this to them is completely normal. And when my BlackBerry now is a touchscreen, but before it wasn't a touchscreen, she touched it and go, Daddy, it's not working because I can't pinch and zoom and swipe, because she's used to that. It's become normal. We talked a bit about influence and clout, peer index, and those sort of things, because back in 2009, if you had influence, you had lots of followers. And I still get really angry when brands say, I just want lots and lots of likes and lots of followers. But why? And then it became followers and engagement. So were you retweeting and replying? I can get a robot to do that. I think we're now looking at most number of my friends talking about the topic, because Justin Bieber is probably the most influential person on Facebook and Twitter and everything. But if you're a nappy brand like Pampers and you want to find mummy bloggers, Justin Bieber probably isn't your man. So while he has the biggest score, he's completely useless in certain social networks and certain communities. So how do we find these communities and actually help reach out to them and start having a conversation? Good example of where you can have these influencer things going wrong. So on the Huffington Post, if you type in Japan food radiation, it says that this guy, Health Ranger, is a top influencer on the topic. He's got a clout score here of 70. But if you actually look at who he is, he's some dude in Ecuador who does consumer health advocacy. And so a machine has said, we've done a keyword match and this guy is probably really influential. So if you're a brand, you're actually selling to the wrong people and selling to the wrong community if you choose that. So that's an error that we can get into quite easily. So what we want to do is be able to find these community champions. And so what we do at People Browser is we start to segment people into communities of influence and communities that are like-minded. So we already can find you dog lovers or lawyers or people that like food or your own community. And what I want to spend some time next is to see how you can actually look at mirroring demographics and what people watch on television. And this is a really interesting case study. And we presented this during the week at AdTech. And Jody, our CEO, gave this presentation. He started off by saying, is anyone here from Nielsen? And the room was silent. By the end of the presentation, a lady came up to him and said, and gave him her card, and she was from Nielsen. She was very upset with what we were going to say, because we've been quite controversial to say that we think that social TV analytics could actually replace Nielsen for media buying. Now, how many people here know how many people, you know what a people meter is? People meter is sits on your television and shows what channel you are tuned to at what time of the day. So it shows what you're exposed to. Were you tuned to channel 53 or channel 1 at that particular time? It doesn't tell you necessarily who was watching it. You might have to push a button to say, I'm the female AB1 in the house. But how many people here know how many people meters are actually in the UK? Yeah, I hear between 2,400 and 5,400. So let's give them the benefit of that and say 5,400. So 5,400 people meters decide what 61 million people watch. Statistically correct about what people are exposed to. So we actually, this is a real case study. This is live in the US, and I'm going to bring it to the UK. An agency in the US said, you have this massive data on Twitter. You have 1,000 days and 55 billion tweets. What about if you went through and looked at what people were saying about TV shows? I've just watched House. I'm loving 30 Rock. Isn't so-and-so a wicked show? Because if they mention the show, you can actually line up with when the show went to air and also what ads were there. So it's about engagement, not just exposure. And so we've done this. We've gone and looked at TV show preferences of social media. We've implemented the traditional ratings, so we call them AB1s and happy holiday makers and mummy bloggers or whatever we call them. We have to call that so that media people will buy the same space. And so what we've done is we've actually gone and looked at 900 major TV shows in the US. And that's not a trivial task. We've also then looked at composing audiences, panels, if you like, based on people's affinities and communities. And this is also not trivial. Think of a show like House. So if I mention I've just watched House, we somehow have to get that from 10,000 tweets a second saying, I've just moved house, I'm buying a house, I like my house. So we've got to look at House, or Gregory House, or Gregory House, or Dr. House, and this is just the start of it for every one of those 900 TV shows. Some are easier than others. 30 Rock is a bit easier than House. We also look at what we call AKAs, also known as, so am I talking about something to do with the program, typos, characters' names. So we've actually got to look at all that 900 times. That's one way to slice it. Then we look at finding, filtering out the noise, contextual proximity, exclusions, all those sort of things, not my house or the house. This is not trivial, and it took us a while to figure this out. And then for communities, I mean, no one on Twitter says I'm a 25-year-old male, so how do you actually look at communities? Well, this again is where we've got the geeks involved. We looked at if they actually say how old they are, we tag them as this person says they're 18. Are they married? Are they likely to be 3 or 4? Probably not. They might talk about profession or followers, and we build these queries as well. So in one area, we have these 900 TV shows that we can identify. We then have communities where we can pick out what community they're in, and with some smart maths and looking at 30 million TV show mentions since January this year, we then come up with these sort of panels. So we've got, at the moment, about 1 million people that we think are under 18. This is not perfect, but we're now lining this up against real Nielsen data to see whether this is a decent proxy. And the traditional TV people, I've been to media agencies who've said, it sounds great, but it's just Twitter. To which I said, it's actually great because you actually know the skew of the demographic. And last time I looked, everyone knows someone who's on Twitter, but there's an influence there as well. So we've had lots of people say, it'll never work. And in about 2 to 3 weeks' time, when I have this running in the UK and I'm actually showing ITV, Channel 4, what people are saying about their shows in real time, maybe their view will change. So you actually get something like this. So you can actually say, okay, for 60 minutes, for this week, what demographics were watching those shows? And the peak's obviously the show air dates. But think about iPlayer and catch-up TV. So they weren't always watching it when the show went to air. What proportion of people are watching in catch-up? And, you know, did they repurpose the show? And then we can click the community button and say, well, let's slice this by community and actually work out what under-18s are watching. So this is an example of mining massive amounts of data, applying some intelligence, and actually making something useful that a media buyer or planner can say, aha, there was a peak for Jersey Shore at that time, and there were subsequent peaks there. That's when my ads were. I'm buying space in this. This is actually a useful media buy. And it lines up with what Nielsen are telling me, or what we probably will start to see is there's a skew, because 5,400 people meters don't actually tell you that people were engaged with the show and talking about it. I'm going to spend the next 10 minutes talking about a thing we're launching actually on Thursday in the US called CRED. You've probably all heard of Clout and Peer Index. We've used our 55 billion tweets and 1,000 days of data and 100 million at names to actually look at where the relationships are between different people. And so we look at not just a number out of 1,000 or whatever. We look at a dual score. We have a score for influence in terms of, you know, users' relative ability to inspire action from others. We have a separate measure called outreach. And this is the kind of the generosity level. So if I retweet and I forward things on and I talk about other people and I at-name people, I'm quite a generous person. And we looked at Gabrielle's score today. And in fact, Gabrielle's about 700 over 6. It's actually really good because the 6 means she's a really generous person and she's actually out there promoting content and sharing it. So if I'm the brand, I don't just want one score because Justin Bieber will be 1,000. And so what use is him to me? I want a Cheryl Cole type person who's going to rave about my brand, so go and find someone like that. But I want a Gabrielle who is going to be really generous and authentic about talking about my brand as well. So we think the two, the yin and the yang, will be really useful in finding real influencers. Now, this isn't just across all of Twitter. It's actually looking at communities. So we can find the mummy bloggers, the coffee lovers, the people that like going to Media 140 conferences, and actually look at their scores as well. And so, you know, influence is what others do for you, looking at retweets and replies and follows, all those sort of things. And as I said, outreach is about generosity. And we'll be able to give every single person a little scorecard, which will also show an activity statement, a bit like a frequent flyer statement. Some of the criticisms of existing influence networks are they're very closed, it's all a black box, no one knows why the score goes up and down. You'll actually be able to click on it and see, why did my score go up? Because Gabrielle retweeted me and she has a really high outreach score, that's why my score went up. And we'll be able to do that on different communities. So this person, Paul Smith, we can see which communities he's very popular in, the most used hashtag, most clicked links, the people that he most mentions. It is another way of looking at that. Now, this is not all that we do. We're not trying to be a clout or period next. That's what they do and do very well, and they have perks and those sort of things. Because our main business is analyzing this massive data, this is an extra thing that goes on top. So it means when you're looking for a mention of your brand, you can then say, aha, what are people saying about Starbucks? Who are the influential people in London? Because Starbucks is a very, very global brand. And if you type Starbucks into our machine, it goes whoosh. I can then say, I always want the people in London in the CEO community talking about Starbucks and pull that out. And that's when the data, this massive data that's raining down on Little Brother becomes really, really useful, putting it into different demographics. So we think what we're going to see is that the Little Brother, that's all of us, will carry to the next level of evolution because we can find these influencers and authorities authentically and actually do something with it. Thanks very much.